right? I know that everybody is here because they want to hear about homological mirror symmetry, but I'm sorry, Paul couldn't come, so, and I'm not going to talk about homological mirror symmetry. Yeah, so what I'll try to do is present a story about deep brains in type 2b backgrounds mainly. I'll talk a little bit about type 2a today. But I would like to present a point of view which is, of course, purely mathematical first, and second is kind of not traditional. It's not not what people usually do with deep brains. It's related to Higgs bundles, and I would like to try and convince you that Higgs bundles are a very useful device for encoding information about brains, and in fact for understanding the moduli spaces of brains in a wider context than they are usually treated. In particular, my main objective would be to try and convince you that Higgs bundles, when they are related to brains, allow you to talk about all sorts of deformations of the brains, in particular the ones that include non-trivial B fields and the non-commutative ones. So, yeah, the secret part of my title is non-commutative geometry, but since I know very little about non-commutative geometry, I didn't want to put it officially on the title. All right, so let me start with something very, very basic. Maybe a little boring, which is the review of the spectral construction. So this will be the main character, actually, of all my talks. It's a very basic form of a mathematical duality that is used to simplify geometric questions. So very often in mathematics, what we do is we try to take different viewpoints of some object, and the way we manage to do it is by inventing some duality that converts that object into something completely different. And so at the end of the day, you are left with two objects which work differently. They're equally complicated, but you can capture some features on each side by looking at them. So the typical example would be, say, the Fourier transform on locally compact groups. Right? It converts discrete data into continuous ones, and vice versa. So the spectral construction is another instance of the same kind of process, but it's geometric. And since Robert is going to tell us all about all we need to know about geometry of matrix models, it fits very well because it's a particular matrix model of a geometry. So the basic setup, so where does the spectral construction come from? It comes from this basic idea that you can describe a linear operator on a vector space in terms of its spectrum. So the simplest setup for the spectral construction is we have a V, which is going to be a finite dimensional complex vector space. And we have an endomorphism of V, linear endomorphism. And if the endomorphism is generic, which in this case means diagonalizable, then you can specify this endomorphism by specifying a bunch of numbers, which are its eigenvalues. A bunch of lines, in V, which are the eigenlines, and, well, you need one piece of extra datum, namely the matching between the eigenlines and the eigenvalues. Okay. Yeah. Now lambdas are just a complex numbers. And these are lines. Sorry. With the L's, thank you. These are lines inside B. Okay. Now, so this is the thing. Okay. Nothing very profound. The spectral covers that people usually talk about, they appear when you let this picture vary in families. Get spectral covers. If we let phi vary in families. So, let's see, how did I set it up? So we have a family of endomorphisms. So we have some parameter space S. And I'll have a family of endomorphisms, phi sub s, endomorphisms of v. Phi sub s depends on the parameter s. And now, yeah, so if I assume again that all those are generic, so repeating the construction, for each s, now instead of a bunch of numbers, we get a covering space of s. So we get a space s bar, which is contained in s cross c, and s bar is the space of all pairs, s and lambda, such that lambda is an eigenvalue of phi sub s. Okay. And if all phi sub s have distinct eigenvalues, have simple spectra, then get and we get lines labeled by points in the spectral cover. This is a line, which is just the unique lambda eigenline for phi sub s. Okay? So you see what's happening. So under this very strong genericity assumption that we have a family of simple operators, operators with simple spectrum, we get a covering space of the parameter space for our endomorphisms, and out of each point of that covering space, we have a line sticking. So we really get a line bundle on the total space of this covering space. So this L, lambda S's, fit together in a line bundle, in a complex line bundle, let's call it L on S bar. And the data of the family of endomorphisms, so the data of the map phi from S to the endomorphisms of V, is completely encoded. In this geometric data. a covering space S bar sitting in the product of S and C, and a line bundle on S bar. Knowing one is the same as knowing the other. Now, it's a nice correspondence. So this is what I was talking about. There are two objects that work completely differently, but are the same. And so you have the freedom of treating this object in this context or treating it in this context, whatever your preference is, and you can extract information either way. Unfortunately, this correspondence is not very useful the way I stated it because of this simple spectrum condition. You see, under the simple spectrum condition, this covering space S bar is going to be unramified. Right? We have n distinct points over each point of S. And this line bundle, so we really have an atal covering of S. For example, if S is simply connected, it's going to be totally split. Right? And the line bundle information also, well, it's a line bundle, but you know, we lost all the interesting behavior of varying endomorphisms when you allow eigenvalues to collide. Okay, so.
No.
I could if, but that's a, but you know, that's extra datum. I mean, that would. I mean, I'll come back to that. I mean, yeah, depends where your endomorphisms are. I mean, where your phis are. I mean, right now my phis are in a fixed vector space. So. Well, yeah, so depends what you really want to do. If you really just want phi up to a conjugation, then you don't. But if you want phi on the nulls, you do need the data of embedding of S bar in S cross C. And also the data of L in S bar cross V, thank you. Okay, so if there are phi s which are not simple, which have repeated eigenvalues, then of course you still can define S bar. You're just going to get a branch covering space. It will be a branch covering space. But there is a problem with making the analog of L into a geometric object. L does not always make sense. As a geometric object, which in this case just means a sheaf. Okay, so so a priori, you would like to say that you replace the eigenlines by the generalized eigenspaces corresponding to that eigenvalue, and those fit together into some kind of a sheaf object on S bar, but it doesn't always happen. There are discontinuities in this process. But there is an important special case. Such repeated eigenvalue behavior, which is when phi s can have repeated eigenvalues, but have only one Jordan block per eigenvalue. So in Lie theory, such elements are called regular. Now, this is the case where you don't have any ambiguity about the choice, right? For each eigenvalue, you have a unique space, which is a generalized eigenspace with a unique eigenvector. Okay, so let me just spell this out a little bit more explicitly. Yeah, so maybe I should say, why is that important? In this case, we get again spectral datum, which is a covering S bar inside S cross C, and L on S bar with an embedding in S bar cross V. And L is again a line bundle. And again, you get a completely invertible way of reconstructing the family of endomorphisms from the spectral data and the spectral data from the family of endomorphisms. So that's why this case is important. This is the only case of colliding eigenvalues for which the sheaf on the spectral cover, even when it makes sense, will be a line bundle. The spectral cover, by the way, can be very singular in this case because it is branched, of course, because we have colliding eigenvalues, but it also can have singularities. But nevertheless, the sheaf on it will be a line bundle. Yes?
So you can sort of see where the generalized eigenspace for that eigenvalue where you're getting a singularity is coming from. But how about the filtration?
Yeah, it will come from the filtration by the order of the maximal ideal on the singularity of S bar. So you take the powers of the maximal ideal at the singularity, and that will be a finite depth singularity, and that would give you the filtration. Yeah, so it's encoded in the singularity of S bar. S bar does not have to be singular, but it's encoded in the singularity of the map from S bar to S. It's a branch map, so. All right, so yeah, let me just write that a little bit more explicitly because it will come up later. So more invariantly, we have the characteristic polynomial map H from the endomorphisms of V to Cn, which just sends an endomorphism. How did I normalize them? So it's a map, it's a polynomial map. Sends an endomorphism to the coefficients of its characteristic polynomial, considered as functions of the endomorphism. So let me just, the convention I'm using is that we start with t to the n, and then these are just a1. Is this how I label them? Yeah, a1. All right, so we have this map, which I denoted by H because it's a baby version of the Hitchin map, which is going to come up later on. And it gives you the equation of the spectral cover. So the spectrum of each endomorphism, of course, depends only on its image under H, because it depends only on the characteristic polynomial. And so all spectral covers all meaning corresponding to maps phi from S, some parameter space, to the endomorphisms, come from a universal spectral cover, which is a cover of Cn. So there is one basic spectral cover which lives over Cn, and all of the others are just pullbacks from that. Come as fiber products. So the point is that there is a spectral cover Cn bar sitting inside Cn cross C, and as you can imagine, Cn bar consists of all A1s up to An and a T, such that T is a solution of the polynomial with coefficients A1 to An. Right? And then if you have, I have room here, fit it here. So now if you have, if you have a map from S to the endomorphisms of V, you can compose it with the Hitchin map to Cn. Over Cn, you have Cn bar, and you can pull it back. And that's the spectral cover. So S bar is whatever, the fiber product of S and Cn bar, where here the map is just H composed with phi. And here the map is the projection. Okay, so that's the equation of the spectral cover for every S, but it comes from some universal equation, which is got given there by our vector space. And then there was this issue of how the generalized eigenspaces vary with the points of this guy. And now you can actually answer this question completely rigorously by using this universal model, namely, so the crucial remark here is that the fibers of the Hitchin map are GLV invariant. And in fact, the Cn there is the quotient of the endomorphisms by GLV. But of course, you have to make sense of this quotient. The point is that GLV acts on the endomorphisms by conjugation. The orbits are not in general closed. So if you just take the set theoretic quotient with the induced topology, it's not going to be Hausdorff. So what you do in order to make up this quotient actually a nice space, a nice algebraic variety, is you take a quotient in the sense of geometric invariant theory, which in this case just means that you declare the points in the quotient to be not orbits for the action, but closures of orbits for the action. So this is the JT quotient parameterizing closures, Zariski closures of GLV orbits on the endomorphism space. Okay? And now you see that we are in a kind of an ambiguous situation, because if I take an orbit and I close it, it will contain many orbits of smaller dimensions. So if the orbit is generic, by the way, so if I have an orbit of an endomorphism which is an endomorphism with simple spectrum, then the orbit is closed. So I haven't done anything. The closure of that orbit is just the orbit itself. And we have only one case. So this was our original situation when we had distinct eigenvalues. But if the orbit is not generic, if it has repeated eigenvalues, then the closure of the orbit may contain orbits of smaller dimension. And so if you put this equivalence relation on orbits, call two orbits equivalent if they have something common in their closure, you get the points of this space. Now, in each point in this space, you have a closure of an orbit representing that point. In this closure of an orbit, there are two preferred orbits. There is an open orbit, which is of maximal dimension. It has the same dimension as the closure. And there is a closed orbit, which is of the smallest possible dimension. So in each point in this space, which is a union of orbits, each of them sitting at the boundary of the other, there are two ones that are preferred. One is the one of maximal dimension in the point, an open one, and there is one in the of smallest possible dimension, the closed one. So the closed one just corresponds to the orbit of the semi-simplification of your endomorphism. You write the Jordan canonical form and you forget about the upper diagonal part. You just keep the eigenvalues. And take the orbit of that, that's the closed orbit in each point. The open one corresponds exactly to the regular representative in your orbit. You take all the eigenvalues and you take one Jordan block per eigenvalue. And now, if you want things to vary continuously, you can analyze what's happening, but it's not surprising that the open ones are the ones that vary continuously, whereas the closed ones do not. So that's one big problem people have to deal with when they construct moduli spaces by geometric invariant theory, because intrinsically, the points in a moduli space constructed by geometric invariant theory has a representative, which is a sum of stable objects, in this case, sum of simple objects. This is the closed orbit. But this representative does not vary continuously with the point in the moduli space. So from the viewpoint of the moduli problem, it's a very unnatural representative. And in many moduli problems, when you solve the problem by geometric invariant theory and you try to represent your object by a canonical, your point by a canonical object so that it will fit in any family, it's not possible. You have to allow all possible limits, and that's why you get an equivalence class. But luckily for endomorphisms, it is possible. There is always a preferred limit, which is the regular endomorphism. Okay, so what do I want to do now? So I would like to generalize this picture or extend it in several ways. In fact, in two ways. So the first way it's useful to generalize it to replace the endomorphisms of V and the group GLV that we were playing with here by some Lie algebra and its Lie group. We have to take them to be reductive. I was taking elements in the Lie algebra of GLV, and I was looking at them up to conjugation, and I was constructing some geometric data corresponding to those elements. In principle, you can do the same thing for any elements in a Lie algebra, families of elements in a Lie algebra, and the adjoint action of the corresponding Lie group. So that's one extension one would like to have. But more importantly for us is to allow for twisted versions of phi. Okay, so part one I'm not going to discuss. uh, not in detail at least. I may mention some examples every now and then. Part two is what I'll be really talking about. But yeah, so there is extensive literature on this part. In particular, there are many papers from discussing this issue. Now, for the twisting, well, there are many ways in which you can imagine twisting family of endomorphisms. So I would like to twist phi in two ways. So we'll consider two procedures for twisting. The first one, well, I took my phi to be an endomorphism in a fixed vector space. So I took my phi to be a family of endomorphisms in a fixed vector space. There is nothing in this picture that forces me to do that. I can easily take a family of vector spaces depending on the points in S. So take phi to be a section in the endomorphism bundle of a vector bundle on S. That's perfectly acceptable. Okay, and so that was the first simplifying assumption I had in this picture. The second one, but that's completely innocent. I mean, just replacing a vector space, fixed vector space, with a family of vector spaces doesn't do you any harm. But the second one is actually subtler. I would like to allow, so I allowed my eigenvalues to be numbers. I would like to now allow my eigenvalues to be other things. So so take different coefficients. For phi, so this just means replace C, the space where the eigenvalues live, by some coefficient object K. So formally, this would mean that I'm taking phi to be a section in the endomorphisms of a vector bundle tensored with this coefficient object. Well, of course, I'll have to be able to make sense of that. So it's natural to require this to be an abelian group. And there are many choices, and they all lead to meaningful generalizations. So you can take K to be a vector bundle. Think about C as the trivial vector bundle. You can take K to be a torus. You can take K to be torus, I mean, an abelian variety here. We are doing algebraic geometry. You can take it also to be an affine torus. So this pretty much exhausts all families of abelian groups that we see algebraically. But we don't have to actually keep them to be groups. We can allow them to be stacks. And that will also come up. So I can take K to be any commutative group stack. And that's how the B fields are going to come in. All right, so now, sorry?
Is the affine torus a group?
Yeah, like C star to the N. Affine torus means an affine algebraic variety, which is also a group.
Oh,
No, affine torus. No, not a torus for a torus. Affine torus just, it's not the analog of an affine bundle. By the way, an affine bundle also can be taught as a group, which will come in later on, because it is it corresponds to an extension of a group by a group, right? And it's just a fiber of over the non-trivial element in the target group. But I'll get to that when I get to that. Okay, so now let me talk about the simplest possible extension of this type, which is the notion of a Higgs bundle. So this is when we take K to be a vector bundle. Okay. So now the problem that we were trying to solve, convert a family of endomorphisms into some geometric data that encodes the spectrum, looks like the following. So we have, so start with a vector bundle E on S that's going to be our family of vector spaces. Start with another vector bundle K on S that's going to be our family of coefficients. Take a global section of the endomorphisms of V twisted by K. So that would look like a map phi from E to E tensor K, which is linear with respect to multiplication by functions. Okay? And now we would like to represent that by spectral data. We would like to replace this by a spectral cover and preferably a Wien bundle on top of that spectral cover. Okay, now you see that we are already in trouble if we try to repeat the previous construction directly, because there is a problem. The spectrum of phi, just the cover, may not be well defined for a general phi. And it's very easy to see that that's the case, because what is phi really? Well, if you trivialize, so if we choose an open V inside S and a trivialization of the coefficient bundle, so K restricted to V, I identify with K copies of the trivial Wien bundle, so I'm going to write this, then on phi, on V, phi is given by just K endomorphisms, phi 1, phi 2, phi K, corresponding to now just sections of E on V, endomorphisms. Now, for each of those, I can certainly construct a spectral cover, because for the endomorphisms of E, the spectrum lives in the numbers. So I can take just a collection of all those K spectral covers and declare that to be the spectral cover of phi, and I certainly have to take those because they are, for each point, approaching that point from different directions will give me different endomorphisms, and these eigenvalues of these K guys encode all those different spectra. So I have to take those, I have to take the union of those, but now if you change the trivialization, you immediately see that this union just changes. It's not a well-defined subspace in V cross the numbers. So you have to put some condition on phi that would allow you to control how those spectra for the different coordinatizations of phi fit together. And there are different ways to do that. The most brutal one and the most useful one turns out to be to make phi, these phis to have similar spectral behavior. So to make sense of the spectra of the phi i's, independent of trivializations, require that they are simultaneously diagonalizable. So require that phi I span a commutative subalgebra of the algebra of global sections of the endomorphisms of it. And you can, so this just means that the phi i's commute pairwise, and you can encode that in just one global condition, which is independent of the trivialization. And it is just the condition that phi wedge phi thought of as a section in the endomorphisms of E tensor the wedge square of K is zero. So these are two endomorphisms. You can compose them as endomorphisms and wedge their form coefficient, their K coefficients, and you require that this is zero. So, okay. So it's kind of an integrability condition, as we'll see later on. So this is leading to our first definition, which is Higgs bundle on S is a pair, vector bundle on S, and a k-th valued endomorphisms of that vector bundle, such that phi wedge phi equals zero. And of course, in the same way, you can define a Higgs sheaf. You just replace E by a sheaf. By the way, I should call that a k-valued Higgs bundle. And I'm assuming algebraic throughout, or complex analytic. I mean, when I come to A-brains, they won't be, but I'll say it explicitly. Okay, so yeah, so let me just very briefly discuss the spectral construction for Higgs bundles. So the Higgs bundles are somehow the minimal set of objects for which the spectral construction will make sense, or the maximal, depending on your point of view. Okay, so it's convenient actually to rewrite that a little bit differently. So I can rewrite the Higgs field for a bundle at least. I'm sorry, not for coefficients which are a vector bundle. I can rewrite the Higgs field as a map from from K dual tensor E to E. Now I can look at the free algebra generated by K dual. So we get an action of the free associative algebra generated by K dual on E. So the free associative algebra generated by K dual is just the tensor algebra. So I get an action from that to E. And this integrability condition that we put in, so this is just for a phi with no conditions on it. The integrability condition just tells you that that action actually factors through an action of the symmetric algebra. So phi wedge phi equals 0 if and only if this action factors as an action from the symmetric algebra of K. So we started with some coefficient object. We got a free algebra generated by that coefficient object acting on our E. And now we forced it to be a free commutative algebra by this integrability condition. It's just the tensor algebra, yeah. Yeah, how do we distinguish it from tangent bundles? Bold face T. Okay, but now, if you have done any algebraic geometry, you stare at that for a moment, and you realize that once you have an action of a symmetric algebra on anything, it is a geometric creature. So sim K dual is, in fact, a bundle of algebras on S, which equals the relative algebras of functions on the total space of K. K was a vector bundle, the total space of K is a variety. If I look at functions along the fibers, this comes with a projection to S. Functions on a vector space are just polynomials, which are the symmetric algebra on the linear functions on that vector space. And if you put that together, varying over S, you get exactly this family of algebras. So, yeah. So the way we say it in algebraic geometry, we say that the total space of K is the relative spectrum of the symmetric algebra. Right? Over S. But, So what we got now, we got this family of algebras, which is the same as the geometric object, which is the total space of K, and we got a module over it. That's what our Higgs bundle was. It was just a module over it. So the data of E and phi is the same thing as a module over sim dot of K dual, which is the same thing as a sheaf. Quasi-coherent sheaf. On the total space K. So by this usual Grothendieck-Yoga, you get a translation between Higgs bundle data and sheaf data on the total space of this K. So let me just introduce a notation. X will be the total space of K. The projection map I called P. So I have an algebraic variety mapping to S. It's a pretty boring algebraic variety, total space of a vector bundle. But quasi-coherent sheaves on that algebraic variety are the same thing as quasi-coherent Higgs sheaves. Yeah, obviously, if you just start with a vector bundle, you're not going to get arbitrary quasi-coherent sheaves. So this Grothendieck Kyoga gives you a correspondence between quasi-coherent sheaves on X, which is an equivalence of categories, and quasi-coherent Higgs sheaves on S. Because they can be infinite rank. They can be infinite rank. So for example, if you start with the most simple quasi-coherent sheaf on X, which is the structure sheaf, the trivial line bundle, what you get downstairs is you get SIMK dual with the Higgs field, which is just a contraction by the element of K. So they can be infinite rank. So we have quasi-coherent sheaves on X and quasi-coherent sheaves on S. I'll say in a moment what the correspondence explicitly is. But of course, in principle, you are interested in Taymor objects, say coherent sheaves on X. Well, those are harder to describe down here. So let's try to describe coherent Higgs sheaves on S. So coherent sheaves on S turn out to correspond, of course, to coherent sheaves on X, but not arbitrary coherent sheaves on X. They correspond to coherent sheaves on X, which are finite over the base. So you want coherent sheaves that are supported on subvarieties in X that map finite to 1 to the base. Basically, the problem is that the fibers of this map are not compact, and you don't want your supports of coherent sheaves to shoot off at infinity. You want to keep the supports to be compact. And of course, in an affine space, the only algebraic compact subvarieties are collections of points. So that's why you want your supports to be finite. E is a coherent sheaf. K is fixed once and for all. E is a coherent sheaf, yeah. K is fixed once and for all. E is the thing that varies. E and phi are the things that vary. Yeah, so let me just say what the correspondence is. If I start with a quasi-coherent sheaf on X, then you get the corresponding Higgs sheaf downstairs by just pushing forward. So you take E to be the push forward of this script E, and you take phi to be the push forward of the multiplication by lambda, where lambda is the tautological section. You see, upstairs, you have this tautological section in K because X is the total space of K. So at each point of X, you have a point in the fiber of K. So you get a section in the pullback of K. And upstairs, if you start with E, you can multiply by lambda, and you get E going to E tensor the pullback of K. And now if you push that forward, you get something, which is the push forward of that, and you get an endomorphism. So that's the map this way. And in the opposite direction, well, this tells you what to do. If I is a Higgs sheaf on X, then you can pull back E pullback E tens of k. And now here you have two maps. You have the map phi, and you have the map lambda, multiplication by lambda. Subtract them, you take the kernel. So if you go back and examine what we were doing for a fixed vector space, this is exactly what we were doing. This just tells you that the fiber of E looks like an eigenspace for phi. Right? Lambda parameterizes exactly the points in K, which we should think of as values of our endomorphisms. And this is the characteristic polynomial. I mean, the matrix whose determinant is a characteristic polynomial. So this script E guy is exactly the spectral data. Its support is the spectral cover, and considered as a sheaf over its support, it is the line bundle or whatever sheaf we get. So E is the spectral data. The support of E is S bar, corresponding to E and phi. Okay. But now you can see why I was saying that Higgs bundles should be related to brains. Because what did we do? We got a sheaf on some space X. We translated it by this simple spectral construction, this duality process, into sheaf on another space together with an extra data. And next time, I'll show you that. So the idea would be to take this basic correspondence and plug it into some high-tech machinery. The point is that this correspondence is a particular instance of a very well understood mathematical duality, which is causal duality. So I'm going to rewrite this as an instance of causal duality and then see how to deform these objects in all possible ways, in particular non-commutatively. So the real objective, of course, is to try and deform the script E. Because if you think about X being a Calabi-Yau, the script E is going to be a B-brain on that Calabi-Yau. So you want to understand all possible deformations of that B-brain. So we'll convert it by this duality to something on a different space. And we'll start looking at deformations on both sides. And you'll see that all sorts of deformations that look differently on the two sides. So by examining them on the two sides, we can actually handle them. OK, but before I do that, let me just talk about briefly about some setups in which D-brains connect to Higgs bundles. Well, so the simplest possible setup is if you take S to be a compact Keller manifold with a Keller metric G. And you require G to be real analytic. I'll say why. Now you take K, our coefficient bundle, to be the one forms on S. The total space of this K, I was calling it X, so this is just the total space of the cotangent bundle of S, mapping to S. No, homomorphic. This is the homomorphic cotangent bundle. Everything is algebraic for me. Homomorphic cotangent bundle. Yeah, so the total space is an algebraic symplectic manifold. Right? Total space of a cotangent bundle, it has an exact homomorphic symplectic form. But in fact, and it does contain our original S sitting inside as the zero section. So it's a homomorphic submanifold in this algebraic symplectic manifold, which is a Lagrangian submanifold for the homomorphic symplectic form. Now, what's interesting is that this is not only algebraic symplectic, but it is also hyperkeller near S. So I think in 1999, Berthe Fikes and Kaledin showed that a formal neighborhood of S inside X has a unique hyperkeller metric, which restricts to G, to the chosen Keller metric on S. And in fact, if G is real analytic, it's not only a formal hyperkeller metric, but it integrates to a tubular neighborhood of the zero section. It's hyperkeller metric on a tubular neighborhood. Yeah, so unfortunately, this metric is never complete. There are all sorts of conditions that tell you how far it integrates. So, in fact, hyperkeller manifolds were discovered by Kawabe in exactly that way. What he did was he looked at the cotangent bundle of a projective space, and he realized that there is a canonical hyperkeller metric on the neighborhood of the zero section, which then he checks that integrates on the total cotangent bundle. And in fact, for a very long time, these were the only examples of this setting, projective spaces and homogeneous spaces with which are funnels, which with a positive canonical class, negative canonical class, and there it also integrates on the whole cotangent bundle, still non-completely. It's not complete at infinity, so in many cases, actually, you can extend it by homogeneity. You have the S1 action on the total space of the cotangent bundle, and you just can take it from the small neighborhood and just push it down by homogeneity. What's interesting is that sometimes, in very special situations, you can invent a partial compactification of the cotangent bundle so that the metric actually becomes complete. So the typical example is the moduli space of Higgs bundles. But anyway, in this completely general setting, just start with a Keller manifold, we produce a hyperkeller manifold of the type we were talking about, or at least a piece of that hyperkeller manifold. And so you can talk about non-compact one, but you can talk about, you can use it as a string background. So in particular, locally, yeah. Meaning locally on S? Yeah, sure. But locally on S, locally what do you mean, infinitesimally? Yeah, but infinitesimally every Keller metric is flat. So that doesn't tell you much, The real issue is what happens when it varies from point to point. This is an extremely hard theorem, by the way. It's a serious theorem. The proofs are completely different. So Kaledin uses very heavily Hodge theory. and realizes these transversal directions as some variation of Hodge structures. Bertha Fryx uses the twister construction and writes special coordinates. But you know, it's a special geometry issue, really, right? You have to write somehow good special coordinates near each point. And for example, the standard special coordinates people write are not good enough on general hyperkalemetrics. Right, I mean, kelemetrics give you special coordinates on Kelem manifolds in the way Bershadsky, Sassotti, Oguri, and Waffer wrote them, right? So you can, those work very well, say, on a torus. So if you write those special coordinates on a torus, and you write the twister space, you can just write down the hyperkalemetric explicitly. But if you take a curved space, they don't work well. You have to correct them. And in fact, the corrections are not explicitly known. It's an existence theorem. What Fryx proves is that you can take those and add to them corrections term by term so that the whole thing will make sense. Yeah, but going back to the Higgs bundle story, now if I want to understand coherent shifts on this guy X, I can in terms of Higgs bundles. So coherent shifts E on X correspond to Higgs bundles. These are just the classical Higgs bundles where phi has one form coefficients. And by non-abelian Hodge theory, by Simpson's and Corlett's work, these guys correspond to flat connections. Well, under Chernkov's restrictions. Yeah, so this will be quasi-coherent Higgs shifts in general. But if you want them to be vector bundles, you want coherent shifts finite over the base. So under restrictions on the Chern classes of E, these correspond to flat complex connections on S. And these are purely topological. They correspond to the representations of the fundamental group of S, so you can study them. So you get your hand on many brains completely explicitly. And as far as I know, maybe this picture is not very interesting for real string quantifications, but I haven't seen it explored anywhere. I think it's interesting. So that's one setup where we see Higgs bundles. Yeah, I'm sorry. I'll have to go for an hour and a half. I'll try to stop 2 minutes earlier, but we only have 4 talks, so if I want to go somewhere, I need to. Okay, so that's one setup. Another setup second setup I want to talk about is you start with Z, which is a three-dimensional Calabi-Yau compact. You take a smooth curve in Z. So now, in M theory, people look at the moduli space of BPS brains on Z, labeled by C and R. So these are just BPS states, BPS brains, whose support on Z, whose support has homology class R times the homology class of C. And you would like to count those. You would like to take this moduli space and compute its virtual Euler class, compute its Euler characteristic. The problem is that mathematically, this is not a well-posed question. The reason it's not well-posed is because we're only fixing the homology class of the support. There are So for example, this does not fix, you know, so if you look at schemes on Z, which are supported on the curve C with length R, there are schemes like that of infinitely many discrete invariants. So you can take curves of infinitely high genus, which are non-reduced curve with R-fold scheme structure supported on C. So you have infinitely many components a priori of guys like that. And they're very easy, you know, I mean, basically any example you write, you see that there are really infinitely many components. I mean, there is no way around that. On the other hand, the Gopa-Kumar and Waffa formula actually counts these things. Right? It really gives you a number that counts the Euler characteristic of this space. So what are we really counting? So here is a proposal that may explain what it is counting. It's just a guess. I don't really know whether it's the right answer or not. A proposal replace the compact Calabi-Yau containing C by its linearization, which is the total space of the normal bundle of C and Z containing C. So the Calabi-Yau is curved along C, just straighten out the normal directions. Now this is a non-compact Calabi-Yau containing C, which is a total space of a rank 2 vector bundle. So there is a explicit deformation to the normal cone from this picture to this picture. Now, yeah, so let's call this X. Now the advantage that we have with the previous situation when C was just sitting in Z is that now not only C is sitting in X, but X also projects on C because we have straightened the normal direction. So we have a projection. And now if I look at the moduli space of BPS states on X that wrap R times C, this is just moduli of coherent sheaves on X, which are finite of degree R over C. Embrace. Oh, because what we're doing is, right, I mean, these BPS states that are supposedly counting the same thing as the Gromov-Witten invariants after rearrangement. You get them typically by taking a curve mapping to your Calabi-Yau and pushing forward the structure sheaf. So you get a torsion sheaf on the Calabi-Yau, which is, you know, the image of that curve with some sheaf on it. And you want the moduli space now of that inside the Calabi-Yau, right? And its Euler characteristic is supposed to give you this Gopa-Kumar-Waffa number. At least this is what they say in the paper. And I've been always puzzled by that, so I'm trying to explain it. And I've been always puzzled by it because I don't really understand this space. But I do understand this space. And so the great simplification that happens is because of this projection map, these are finite. Yeah. The point is that here, well, that's the problem. They don't say anything about the Chern classes. They only say something very simple. They just fix one combination of the Chern class, essentially, the second Chern class. The third Chern class of the sheaf, yeah. The third Chern class can vary, and the first Chern class can vary, in principle. Right? So that's why you get an infinite family. Okay, but now the point is that when you deform to the normal cone, not all of those guys will survive. Yeah. I did not. Because I don't know how. Yeah, exactly. Right. But the idea is, if I just, you know, take the naive thing, right, just fix the homology class of the curve and take all sheaves supported in that homology class, it's huge, right? It still makes sense as a scheme of infinite type. I can take it and try to follow it through the deformation to the normal cone. Now, most of the components of this space are actually going to disappear. They don't, you know, they blend together when you deform to the normal cone. They become the same component under this linearization. You're still left with an infinite set of components here, but if you fix one extra thing, like the Turchin class on this side, for example, then you get a finitely many components on the other side. Yes. I understand what you're saying, right? Because in M theory, you would expect something like a higher gauge theory, like a two-form gauge field on those, rather than. Yeah, we're talking about membranes. Yeah, I don't know how to. You think we should say? I could say the two brains, of course. Yeah, but. No, it was important. Yeah. It was important that they're membrane. So you don't buy the sheet. Yes. Well, there is no vector bundle. That's the whole point. No. But I'm just trying to encode the fact that this curve comes from some R to one curve mapping to it, right? I mean, essentially, I'm trying to encode the fact that I'm trying to encode the trace of the information for a map from a curve to the Calabi-Yau, right? And that's encoded in a sheaf. So somehow, my understanding of the Gopakumar-Vafa statement was that when you count BPS states, you don't really remember all the information about the map, but you only remember the information about the push forward of the structure sheaf. I don't know if that's the correct interpretation, but that's what I got out of that. Yeah.
Is it possible to trace back what description on the other C1 and C3 over here
corresponds to these guys? So which of those actually deform?
Right.
That's hard. That's actually hard. It's easier to go the other way. Fix restrictions here and see what survives there. In some cases, you can. Depends how bad your curve is inside the Calabi-Yau. Depends how curved your Calabi-Yau is near the curve.
I mean, to some extent, that fits part of Greg's question.
Well, this of course, we know. But the M theory BPS states are just the type 2 BPS states that's from coupled. You know that the BPS built the space. Does it this statement make sense just in the type 2 field? I mean, the usual correspondence in counting chromophytic invariants on the one hand and computing BPS states on the other. That's a statement that just makes sense.
Yeah, unfortunately, I have no insight on that issue, even though if somebody can explain it to me, I'll be very happy. Can I just finish with this? I mean, either you regard it as D2 brains or membranes. But the point is that this moduli space is very well behaved, and you can actually compute numbers. I haven't, but you can. The point is that this is the same as the nilpotent cone. I'm sorry, this is the hole. It's not the nilpotent cone. It's the moduli of n-valued, ncx-valued Higgs bundles, Frank R on C. So So it's a very it's Higgs bundles on curves with coefficients around two vector bundles. So you have to worry a little bit about that. So it's not like the typical modular space of Higgs bundles people study. But it's a very well-behaved modular space. In particular, it has a C star action, because you can take a Higgs field and rescale it by a number. So you can do localization on it if you try to, if you want to compute all the characteristics. Yeah, so it would be very interesting to test this proposal and compute some numbers and compare with the Gopi-Kumar alpha formula. Unfortunately, I'm lazy. So. Okay. Now, the next story, unfortunately, I have only 5 minutes, so I don't know if it's worth starting with it now. Yeah, so the last setup I wanted to present about the relationship between D-brains and Higgs bundles is concerning A-brains on collabials. So in certain cases, actually Higgs bundles, but not in the holomorphic setting, some C-infinity version of Higgs bundles, turns out to be useful for describing A-brains and gives you some insights into mirror symmetry. But probably I'll just do that next time, because it would take at least 15 minutes. So.